Welcome to the ABM Conversations Podcast, the number one podcast for B2B marketers wanting to explore timeless account-based marketing strategies to drive revenue, customer engagement, retention, and everything that makes sense to both marketers and sales folks. No more fluff. No more vanity metrics. Live from India, made for the world. And now your hosts, Yog and Manish.
Welcome to yet another episode of the ABM Conversations podcast. This is me, your host, Yagneshwaran Ganesh.
And this is me, Manish Nepal.
Today, we are going to discuss some of the sales and marketing challenges that a typical startup faces when they get started and how they overcome it. Some of the best startups tend to do things that aren't really scalable in the early stages, and at least until they establish a fit with their customers, and then they capitalize things from there. And today, we have an amazing founder of one such startup, Jeroen Kothout, who is the CEO of Salesflare. Welcome to the show, Jeroen.
Hey, thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, we absolutely love this. You know, we love having you on the show. And is this the right way to say this in Dutch? Alleen maar liefde.
That's totally correct. And the pronunciation is even good.
All right. Thank you so much. There are loads of interesting things about you. Let's start with a couple of them. If I'm not wrong, I think you are a dual citizen of the US and Belgium. Secondly, Salesflare wasn't originally intended to be a CRM for smaller companies. You started somewhere else. Like, you started with wanting to solve the problem of salespeople not updating the CRM. So tell us a little bit about how you managed to sell Salesflare without a website, without online payment options in the initial days.
Yeah, no, both are correct. I'm by DNA, let's say I'm fully Belgian, but I was born in the US while my parents were living there for a while. And on the topic of Salesflare, that's correct as well. It was first intended to be a sales platform, which would integrate with big enterprise CRM systems. We basically said to companies like, you have this CRM, it might be Salesforce, it might be Microsoft Dynamics or whatever, and your salespeople are not filling it out. Now, we have a system that is specifically built for sales, just like you have specifically built support or for marketing automation or whatever. And it synchronizes with your CRM, just like these other systems. And it works much, much better for your salespeople. Like, it's easier to use. The flows are the way salespeople expect it. And it also automatically fills out itself, so that finally your salespeople have something they can work with and the data will flow back to the CRM. Now, big companies would say to us, that is cool. We indeed have that issue, but we don't want to buy another system for this. Their expectation was that we wouldn't put Salesflare next to Salesforce. They just wanted to fix Salesforce. So we didn't really get it sold. Especially also they saw an issue in the synchronization. And at the same time, the people around us in the startup incubator were very interested in what we built, because in the systems that they were using to do sales follow-up, they had to do a lot of data input, and the system wasn't really like helping them to sell and to follow up their customers. So it was always sort of something that kept failing. And when we saw that interest, we figured that what we had built was actually a much better fit for smaller companies than it was for larger ones. And that's sort of where it began. Now, to come back to your third part of the question, how we then started selling Salesflare without website. We did have a website, but we didn't offer any possibility to sign up through that website. We basically started off with contacting our own network, largely my network. I contacted people to do customer interviews to understand very well how they were selling, what role software played in that, what the issues they were having in sales, what issues they were facing with regard to the software. And so these initial conversations, at the end, I would always ask, like, which other three people should I talk to? And like that, I did a lot of customer interviews. And these initial people were a very good sort of first set of prospects that we then afterwards could reach out to start selling. Now, next to that, we worked a lot on being present in some magazines and in the local sort of version of the Financial Times. And it's through these sources that we start getting leads. And I then really, like, from start to end, very manually would lead these people through all the steps that it would take to be interested in Salesflare, to get onboarded on Salesflare, to understand how it worked, you know, all the little things.
Yeah, that's a very interesting story, Aaron. And I want to stress that even further, because when Salesflare first came into the scene, I believe in 2014, the CRM market was already a red ocean, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, even today, Salesforce enjoys a lion's share of the CRM industry globally. And there were other equally powerful incumbents when you guys started out, right? But of course, most CRMs have a poor adoption problem across the industry. And most CRM companies also target big companies, big enterprise clients, which involves a lot of processes and long buying cycles. But you guys at Salesflare took the opposite direction and said, nope, we are a CRM for smaller companies, which no one else in the industry says, right? So my next two-part question to you is, number one, what was the thought process behind choosing smaller businesses as your target? And number two, do you plan to be a niche specialist for this market, or would you consider developing an enterprise version in the long time horizon?
Yeah. So you're right. In 2014, CRM space was already a red ocean. I think at that time there were already probably 500 CRM companies, while now there's maybe 600. The big companies like Salesforce have a big share, although I don't think Salesforce share is more than 1/4 of the market, or whether they have actually already reached that point. There were already CRMs for smaller companies around, so we weren't first there, and there's a growing amount of small business CRMs actually, and this is for a good reason, because these big enterprise CRMs, they are not really built for end users. They're not really built for practical use and all that. They are more meant to streamline certain workflows and organizations. And they're very often sort of a building block system that consultants come implement in your company to make sure that the software perfectly fits the way the enterprise works. Now, with small business CRMs, what people expect is that it's something that is much more workable, much more practical, that is super easy to implement. People just take the software and it works for them. And it actually, in the case of CRM, small businesses really expect that it helps them sell. Now, that's where we saw an issue, even with the small business CRMs that were already around in 2014. Because many of these CRMs, although they're much easier to use and much easier to set up, they're still quite a hassle to keep up to date. Because face it, when you have, basically you're selling and you're sending emails, you're placing phone calls, you're having meetings, you get information from people, you meet new people, all these kind of things, every single thing that happens, you need to go into the CRM and document that. And it sort of feels like you're duplicating information in the sense that everything happens sort of in two systems. And when we thought that's really horrible, because it's one, it's extra work. Two, you need a big level of constant discipline to be able to do that. And three, if the data is already available, why don't we just use it? So we thought about a CRM that would plug into all the systems that you're using. It would be available in the systems that you're using. So if you're in your inbox, you see the CRM there. If you're on your phone, you have all the functionality. If you're on your computer, you have it all. It's just everywhere where you'd expect it to be. But it also plugs into your mailbox, into your calendar, into your phone, into your email tracking, your web tracking, social media, all that. And instead of being built primarily for manual data input, we saw a system that was built primarily for automated data input, and that would really employ all the data that that is available. And still today, many systems have more and more evolved into pulling in more and more information. But I think we're still the only system around that really starts from the idea like, okay, the data input should be automated first and then manually second, while every other CRM system out there is still manual first, and then we'll automate part of the data input, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. It totally makes a lot of sense, And, you know, one of the key things that I've observed with respect to CRMs in my career over and over again is that, you know, I have worked with a lot of salespeople. And what I can clearly tell you from my experience is that salespeople hate updating the CRM. And there are several reasons for it. For instance, you know, it feels like too much of a process to update things on the go. Or sometimes, you know, it is so process-oriented that it even numbs them out. And another thing is that there is no specific reward that they get for updating the CRM. For instance, they don't get any input from the CRM. Of course, you know, certain CRMs offer this predictive lead scores, which in my opinion doesn't help much because salespeople already know what are the accounts that they are going to close this quarter at like the back of the hand. So you need something specific, maybe, you know, even actionable inputs to help salespeople on the go. Let's say, for example, talking about something like a nudge on follow-ups, for instance, right? And this is one of the things that I really love about SalesFlare. Like it's one of those very rare CRMs which is built first for the mobile, and maybe it went to become a desktop version much later. So, you know, can you talk us through a little bit on how one can really get a little more thoughtful with their follow-ups? And when you're following up on scale, like how would you establish a connection between targeted accounts and people in those accounts?
Yeah, you're completely right. The whole issue starts actually with how tedious it is to keep it all up to date and to keep track of everything. So that's the first thing I already explained, that we sort of attack there. The software will nudge you to keep the data up to date. So it will say like, oh, there's a new person on that account. You want to add them, and you can accept that. And everything from there just flows in. And then the software also helps you follow up with people at the right pace, and remind you of emails that you need to answer, which are two very basic things in follow-up that will make you more thoughtful about it, and that's where a lot of salespeople fail, because as long as you're sort of following up one person or maybe five people, you can remember these things, right? And you will be able to have a sort of natural conversation going at the right pace with these people. But as soon as you start scaling that beyond this point, that becomes harder and harder, and you need some sort of system. You could, of course, have a paper and indicate on that paper, or you could start having a spreadsheet. But when it's a system that starts organizing a lot of that for you, that's really where you can, as a salesperson, give some part of that responsibility away, partly, I would say, get help with it, and do it much better. And that's probably where you're going to see a large difference in the amount of sales you can close. I know that some of our customers have reported, for instance, I remember one saying that they close a, and that's just three salespeople, that they close a million more a year now. So these things are certainly important, and it's not just on the short term sort of revenue win that you can make, but on the longer run, you will have much, much better customer relationships, people being impressed by how thoughtful you are towards them. You will build better relationships with people, which is in the end, I think, what we all aspire to as well.
Absolutely. And talking of targeted, I think it's only fair for us to take a moment to thank our sponsors, which is Zest.is, and to the listeners of our podcast. Like, if you are looking to promote your content to an elite B2B audience, then you just can't miss Zest.is. Zest, as many of you guys know, that it is a marketing content stream that sits on your Google Chrome browser as a new tab extension. It's a website where you can either discover or submit high-quality articles, podcasts, infographics, videos, and ebooks. Its highly powered algorithm allows you to handpick your own personalized content feed that is specific to your taste.
And Yag and I have been using Zest for many years to promote as well as discover new marketing content. So if you also want to reap the rewards of using Zest to boost your high-quality content to an elite set of marketers globally, go ahead and sign up at zest.is/contentboost. And let them know you came from the ABM Conversations podcast to get an instant $75 off on your first boost.
I actually wanted to add that I'm also a Zest user. So.
Oh, high five.
Yeah.
Well, there comes another validation for how good that product is. So my next question to you, Yarun, was going to be, you know, one of the common go-to-market approaches for most product startups is, they do a product hunt launch and they probably try to offer a deal on AppSumo in the hope to drive early adoption, right? But very few companies realize that if you aren't smart enough about it, you might not only give away too much for free, but also have to work like crazy to deliver on that promise. The reason I'm asking this question is SalesClear was one of the top five products of the day when you launched on product hunt. Which means the sign-up volume would have driven you folks crazy. And to top it off, the customers on AppSumo sometimes tend to expect too much for the lifetime deal they get. Sorry about that background noise. So my question to you is, what are some of the sales and customer support lessons that you might have gotten based on your experience with the product hunt launch and AppSumo launch?
Yeah. I think preparation is key. We had done a lot of preparation for both, but in the case of AppSumo, I would still say too little. In the case of Product Hunt, we have a blog post about that. If you type Product Hunt launch in Google, you should be able to find it. If you add the word Salesflare, you'll probably find it for sure. It describes how we prepared for this product hunt launch, which the first one that we did, we were very thoughtful about it. We thought everything through, from the tagline we used to the graphics and the movable icon, to the hunter we chose, the intro comment, the way we prepared to get this sort of first boost of upvotes to land on the front page and in the top five. Back then, Product Hunt still seemed to deliver many more interested signups than it does today. It seems that this is a bit less now, but it's still a good channel if you want to get if you sort of want to do a launch, because nowadays if you want to try to launch in TechCrunch, that's almost not possible. They only cover investments. So Product Hunt has become sort of the thing that in the past you would launch in the press, now you can launch on Product Hunt and you immediately get a lot of people clicking through. It converts quite well, so that's very nice. I don't think we had any serious learnings like in terms of issues from the Product Hunt launch. From the AppSumo launch, I would say we did. The deal that we did back then, that was pretty good because we did not give everything away for free. Our deal, in very simple terms, was one user for free and all others at a discount. That not only made that we could make some good amount of upsells, it also means that up till today, we have an avenue of expanding our product and still respecting the deal we offered the AppSumo users. It allows these kind of things. What we did not do very well, I must say, is thinking through the volume of people that would come on the software. Up front, we looked at our infrastructure and we thought, it's good enough. It wasn't good enough. Our infrastructure got so much load that was during the whole launch, our developers had to think how to basically... So it's like a plane is flying, and while it is, you completely rebuild it. That's sort of what happened because we went from a single server infrastructure to a fully scalable one during our AppSumo launch. Also, we had a partner that we used back then for our, the syncing of email addresses. We had warned them up front that there was going to be a lot of load, and they said, it's going to be okay. We have a lot of servers, you know, and we actually brought them down during the AppSumo launch with all the new users we got. And also some other things were not super well thought through. Like, we offered free imports to everyone, even though we didn't have an import module yet. And we were just flooded with import work. At some point, we stopped the import work to work on the import module, and then restarted the import work because otherwise we just couldn't do it anymore. In terms of support, yes, it was heavy. I would say to everyone who thinks about launching on AppSumo, make sure that your audience is small companies, mostly small marketing agencies. Make sure that you don't have a lot of extra costs when adding extra users, because otherwise it's probably not worth it. And also, extra costs does not only mean direct costs from hosting or any services you use. It also means extra support costs, because if your product needs a whole lot of support, then that will be about ROI, I would say. But it's not just about the financial rewards you get there with an AppSumo launch. It's also about the amount of feedback that you get to improve your product, the amount of word of mouth you can get if your product is working well, the amount of extra affiliates you can add, the amount of extra reviews you can get on review platforms. All this kind of things will contribute to your success eventually.
Love the story, Yaron. In fact, I personally have an experience of launching on AppSumo, and I must definitely tell you that the Sumo links do expect way too much for the minimal cost that they pay. That's been my experience. But the second thing here, Yaron, something that I came across while doing research about you, I found that you did a research or a thesis on sleep. And I'm sure this whole process of AppSumo gave you sleepless nights for sure.
Yeah, no. It actually, we started doing support on a continuous basis during the AppSumo launch, like 24 hours. And I did the early shifts. So I got up at 4 or something, jumped in the shower, and then immediately sat behind my computer. And at the end of the 3 weeks, that was the AppSumo launch, I was sick together with two of my colleagues who had been doing these shifts. It was just, it was too much for us. But indeed, I did my thesis on sleep and more particularly on sleep apnea to detect it just based on the heart signal instead of needing a whole sleep clinic visit.
I don't know if you would agree with us or not, but you seem to be just like us in so many ways, Yaron. because both Yag and I also don't like to spend too much time with processes. We take life by the horns as it comes. And it's fine as long as you are a small team, right? For me and Yag, it worked well until Yag and I were in the same city when it came to recording this podcast. But once I moved to this new city, different city, and given the COVID restrictions that we have, we had to bring in a little bit of process to get the podcast running smoothly. Otherwise, we were all over the place. You know, we did whatever we liked. So if I had to put you in a similar situation and ask you this question, how was your marketing and sales process changed? How did your marketing and sales process change since January 2020? And how often do you folks at Salesflare have a team meeting?
This year, I must say our marketing and sales did not change so much. I mean, we started doing extra stuff and all that. But our relationship with customers has been online for 5 years now. So we didn't have to make huge changes. The biggest changes for us were more internally. Like you sort of said, we don't like to have too many processes. But we did have too little, especially when it comes to internal communication. That team meeting is something we already had, but there's many things which we have added, especially in the first few months of the COVID situation. We have been working remote since March. We have not gone back to the office, and currently we're in a sort of a second lockdown here in Belgium. Not really, really a lockdown, but sort of, where everybody needs to work from home. That's obliged. But we have also been working from home during the time that was not obliged. We just didn't see how it makes sense to go back to the office and expose ourselves and spread the disease. Now, what we mostly had to change was the way we systematize internal communication. Because before we were working in an office and we were sitting next to each other, and we were sort of doing that because we believed it would make us communicate better. If we sit next to each other, then people can always easily pick up what's being discussed, and you have all this sort of water cooler style communication. But when we started working remotely, we noticed that this, of course, wasn't working at all anymore, but that even before, it wasn't the best way of communicating, this sort of accidental communication. So we put some more processes into place to make communication flow. Some of the things we do, for instance, now is writing conclusions. That's probably the easiest to implement for everybody. Is at the end of each meeting, take a bit of time to think what's relevant to the rest of the team that people should know about the meeting, and then post these conclusions in Slack or whatever you're using, together with a link to the full document with all the notes from the meeting. That really helps to keep information flowing through the company. But next to that, we have team meetings on a bi-weekly basis, like every 2 weeks. We have one-on-ones with everyone every month. We have operational meetings in the development team every week, in the growth team every 2 weeks. We have all kinds of strategic meetings and product scoping stuff, etc. But if you want to read about all that, you can type remote work as remote teams Salesflare in Google, and you'll find that as well. It's a long post that describes all the new stuff we're doing.
Right. So whatever you said, you know, makes a lot of sense. And for me, one of the biggest learnings ever since, you know, the COVID thing started and we started working remote was that online meetings, right? So what I've observed is anything more than having like four people in the meeting, it's always going to be that only two people are going to talk, and then the other two are going to be spectators. So, you know, I've often started to make this more of a one-on-one conversation than making it a group. So have you experienced something like that?
Yeah, we saw something similar. Actually, it is true that if you're with more than three people in a meeting, or it's often two people talking, and then maybe a third person sort of being involved, but then the other people are just sitting around. We saw that happening in some of our feature meetings, like product meetings. And what we then decided is that we would limit those meetings to less people. Because, well, if two people are not really participating, the point isn't really there. And we do write every single conclusion down in a Google Doc, and we do the announcements afterwards. So the other two people can, well, if we were five, you know, in these meetings, can easily catch up in the document. So we started limiting these meetings to three, not to two, because if you're two, then it's you might miss things. That third person still adds a lot of value. Also, if you're trying to decide about something, if you're three people, it's much more easy to have a majority, let's say, on decisions. And that has really helped upping not only the productivity in general, because there's less people in the meeting, but also the productivity in the meetings themselves, because we're all much more actively involved.
Right. Fantastic. And right now, you know, we have reached this beyond the 30-minute mark, which means like you qualify for the rapid fire question section. So in this rapid fire section, what we do is like we shoot five questions at you. The questions are usually short, these are questions where you might have to take a stand. It's like putting you on a spot. So are you ready for it?
Yeah, I'm ready for it.
All right. The questions might be short, but you can give a long answer. You know, there are no restrictions. So here comes the first question. What is your reaction when you hear the phrase "always be closing"?
I at first didn't like the phrase. It makes me feel like you're always trying to you always try to sell stuff to people. Always trying to, but then when I read the book "Secrets of Closing the Sale" by Zig Ziglar.
Yeah.
I started understanding that well, at least for him in the book, closing is not just like this final closing the deal, like buy now kind of thing. But it's every single step in the process that gets a customer closer to a buying decision. So then always be closing can be rephrased to always be like guiding people forward through the sales process. And I do agree with that sort of sentiment.
Right. I love it. You know, I love to rephrase this and say always be compounding, because, you know, build your relationships over a period of time and things will compound.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So here's question number two. What's been more effective as a channel for Salesflare in terms of conversion? Is it inbound or is it outbound? And do you expect this trend to change?
That's inbound. And I have no idea whether it will change.
Right. That makes sense. Right. So here's question number three. What are some of the sales and marketing tools that you guys use at Salesflare?
Some of the things we use most actively is Intercom for our conversations with customers, especially when it comes to support and follow-up and all that. Salesflare, of course, for everything in terms of prospect follow-up when it comes to larger customers, partner follow-up, investor follow-up, all those kind of things. I use a lot of Ahrefs for SEO as well. And then some of the usual things like Google Analytics, and we use GitHub for development. We use Trello for project management, a bunch of other things that are less core.
You did mention Zest.is, so that's...
Yeah, definitely. Zest also, yeah.
Right. I love that. You know, out of the list that you shared, I think the only thing that we have not tried is probably Salesflare, so we'll definitely give it a try. And... I also love the Trello-like homepage, which also gives a single look of whatever is happening across the board.
Yeah, that's sort of the pipeline view.
Right.
That's something that people tend to love indeed. The big difference that Salesforce makes lies beyond this, though, because that sort of Kanban pipeline is something you'll find in many products nowadays. It's more like what happens beyond that with all the data you need to track and the follow-up that is going to make the biggest difference.
Right, right. Makes a lot of sense. So here's question number four. Whom do you find it relatively easier to sell to? Is it to the marketers or is it to the sales folks, and why?
We sell to salespeople. We don't really sell to marketers. There is a small marketing aspect to Salesforce, you could say, with the email workflows. You can send like personalized email sequences at scale. There's things like website tracking and all that, but it's essentially a sales CRM. So it's we sell this to founders, sales directors, and salespeople.
Right, right. Makes sense. And here's the final rapid fire question to you. If somebody who is starting out in the world of sales, what is the one book that you would recommend them to read?
Oh, that's a hard question. One book? And you're just starting out.
Yeah, you can name as many as you want. So as many resources, it's good.
I already mentioned the Zig Ziglar book. It's pretty good. It's not the single book that will solve it all or something. But I recently reread Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, which is always a good read, especially for salespeople. I'm scrolling through my Goodreads list now. I really like the one about prospecting by Jeb Blount. Was pretty good in terms of inspiration for me as well. It's called Fanatical Prospecting: The Ultimate Guide to Opening Sales Conversation and Filling the Pipeline. I could recommend that one as well. In general, if people want book recommendations, I'm on Goodreads. Just type my name and you'll find me. And I review all the books I read since, 20 books ago or something.
That's a very nice segue for me to take this over from Yag here on, because this was a very productive recording for us. We loved hearing your straight shooting, distilled for clarity answers. And I'm sure listeners of our podcast would love it as much as we did. But before we let you go, you mentioned Goodreads. Apart from Goodreads, where can people find you in case they have follow-up questions based on the things that we covered on this show today?
Yeah, if you want to find out more about Salesflare, I recommend you go to salesflare.com. That's Flare is with FLARE. And you can click at the top right to start a trial, get up to 30 days if you complete setup steps. It's a sort of a gamified trial where you get more days as you set up the product. If you want to get in touch with me, LinkedIn is the best place. Don't forget to add a personal message when sending a connection request, because otherwise I have no way of distinguishing you from the regular spammer. But if you add a message, say that you heard us on the ABM Conversations podcast, then also they connect with you.
That's a lovely message, because Yag literally just today made a post on LinkedIn about how cold outreach on LinkedIn is getting very templatized. So that's a timely message from you. Anyways, last question. Would you like to give any parting message, any wise words of advice for people listening to this show?
Oh, you're putting a lot of responsibility on me now. Wise words. I would say, considering the COVID crisis, take care of yourself, take care of your team, take care of your customers, but especially in these days, within a team and for yourself, make sure that everybody has the right working conditions. Make sure that everybody can keep up the motivation, despite of all the changes in the way things work and all that. This is super important. This situation might take longer than we expect, although I don't know what to expect anymore nowadays. But, so make sure that we actually get out of this better instead of worse, I would say.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Yaron. It was a pleasure having you on this podcast. And for our listeners, we'll be back with yet another meaty episode next week. Until then, It's bye from me, Manish Nepal.
And this is bye from me, Yag. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the ABM Conversations Podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share your comments with us. We're constantly looking for your feedback, thoughts, and suggestions to make the show more relevant to you.